Welcome to the WPS Remix Edition of the Plastic Surgery Hot Seat Podcast, presented by the ASPS Women Plastic Surgeons Forum. I'm Dr. Paige Myers, Clinical Assistant Professor at the University of Michigan, and I'm excited to share the latest pearls and pitfalls in aesthetic and reconstructive breast, body, and facial surgery straight from the WPS Symposium.
Hello, I am Essie Yates, board-certified plastic surgeon based out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, owner of the Yates Institute of Plastic Surgery, and today is the breast panel discussion from the WPS Symposium. I'm joined by three esteemed colleagues, Diane Yun-Schwartz, who's going to talk to us a little bit about microsurgery and her experience setting up microsurgical programs in the community, as well as the ERES protocol. Kelly Kleen, who's joining us from California, and she is going to be talking about the incidence of using mesh for secondary breast surgeries. And then Meredith Collins from the University of Kansas, who will be talking to us about improving aesthetic outcomes in breast reconstruction. So first off, for Dr. Yun-Schwartz, I would start by asking you a little bit about the fact that obviously you are a community-based practitioner, but you do a pretty high volume microsurgery practice. How has it been for you going out into the community, into these new hospitals and setting up the programs and having, you know, the fantastic outcomes that you do have?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I learned from this panel is that the community-based microsurgery cases versus the academic cases certainly have different patient bases. In fact, I think sometimes when you're in training, you might be a little discouraged to undertake something like this, but you are in a little bit of a sort of advantageous position because you do have the academic centers nearby, and some of those like really, really tough cases that Meredith is doing, you can kind of like kindly bow out sometimes because, you know, we just don't have that support structure. It's not that I don't really want to take care of those patients. You know, obviously I'd be honored if I could, but it just, the limits of that community-based program. It's sort of like when you have cancer and you want to go on a clinical trial. So Meredith's like a clinical trial and I'm like just standard care. It's like kind of one way to approach it. So I learned a lot also about, you know, some of the challenges of the different patient varieties in all of these reconstructions. But I think the take-home message is that even in the community, because I think some people are also dissuaded by not having friends or people, you can always reach out and sort of, you know, just for those cases, form a temporary alliance or have somebody, you know, come and help you so that you have that support structure or support structure in the OR as well.
So, Dr. Collins, it sounds like you have a pretty complicated autologous practice, a lot of delayed reconstruction, a lot of radiated reconstruction, a lot of patients who've had multiple failed implant-based reconstructions. So tell me a little bit about the things that you're doing, because your outcomes are beautiful, and so you're obviously doing things a little differently to others. So could you give us some tips and pearls on how you're producing these very aesthetic results?
Thanks, Essie. Those are really kind words. I think when you work in an academic setting, you take on the most challenging cases. You have to do whatever comes in the door. I actually have a great relationship with a lot of our community docs, and when they've sort of felt like they've exhausted all of their resources for implant-based reconstruction, I do get a lot of referrals from them, which I really like that relationship, and I always make it a point to follow up and let them know, hey, this gal had her deep, she's doing so great, just so you know. What's going on in terms of what works for me? These are just things I've learned over the years, but I think the most important take-home point is setting yourself up for success from the first case, and that means envisioning how you want the result to look at the very end, and if that means being brave and removing the radiated skin or making sure you get all that scar tissue that's going to limit how your breast is shaped out, and then especially spending that extra time on the donor site to really make it a beautiful tummy tuck like closure. Those are the things that are going to make your patient really happy and give you good outcomes. So I think stamina at the end of those long cases is tremendous. And I'm very fortunate. I have residents and fellows and a PA. So I have a lot of hands in the OR. It's not me closing everything myself. I have done it that way. And I started out in private practice, and that is, I have, my hat is off to you, because that is just a huge challenge. It's so much to undertake on your own. That's a real testament to your talent.
Out of full disclosure, I have very good PAs.
Fair. So, yeah,
and sometimes, you know, if you think about it, your challenges are greater because you're training. So it's not like you get the PA that you've worked with for 15 years. You get the, like, kind of drive-by, you know, who's coming in for a short period of time. I think that's actually probably more challenging, because it's sort of like you have to talk the language from the beginning. But I also just wanted to comment on what you were saying about the community physicians. When I was first going into the community, since I was the only one doing some of these micro cases, I did some cases that, you know, were kind of secondary, like, oh my God, like, I wish I had a place I could send this to. But I think the relationships that you set up, and I think that's very important, if they come from community plastic surgeons who don't do micro, you know, and same with Dr. Colleen. It's really how you approach the relationship. You know, you don't want to react both to the patient. And I think that's important for us all as colleagues. We all respect each other. You know, I was kind of floored by all the presentations today and, you know, sort of the caliber of, you know, what we can accomplish. And I think the take home is, like, you know, don't spit on other people's work either, because, you know, you don't know what the true story is. And, you know, I think it's important to keep those relationships valid, because they'll take you a long way.
I totally agree with you. And I think it's important for the younger surgeons to be mindful of the fact that it is possible to have a successful microsurgical practice in the community, in certain geographical regions. That's a necessity. Otherwise, these patients would not have access to care. And it can be successfully blended. In your case, with a cosmetic practice, from a revenue perspective, from a logistical perspective, but also we really need, you know, those big academic centers and that relationship with them to understand and pinpoint the individuals that can help those patients that would be best served at a larger academic center.
And even academic centers, like, you know, you view it as they have these, like, sort of unlimited resources. That's actually not correct. You know, sometimes, you know, they're sort of forced into maybe sometimes something that the patient might not want because their resources are sometimes limited. You know, you have to kind of save yourself for those, you know, situations. In the same way, I guess one of the advantages of being able to do those salvage cases is, you know, you're going to have some of your own, you know, situations. And it's kind of nice that you can kind of clean up your own act a little bit too. So,
yeah. So I'm going to move on to Dr. Colleen here, who's also an expert in breast reconstruction as well as aesthetic breast, and has a particular interest and a plethora of experience with the utilization of mesh in the breast. So I just wanted to first start by asking if you could share a little bit about who is a good candidate for mesh and what types of meshes that you're using for those procedures.
Absolutely. So I have moved away from dermal matrix to mesh, you know, for a few reasons. So the first reason is just cost. You know, the meshes are just horribly expensive. And with the loss of Belladerm, our cosmetic option, it's just cost prohibitive for a lot of patients. And so I've really struggled with finding meshes that last long enough and will actually improve the patient's capsule formation. So most of the time I'm using P4HB these days, and that's probably, you know, 99% of what I'm using. And the patients that I'm using meshes on are really kind of a really particular set of people. So first and foremost, it's really important if you believe you have a patient who makes poor capsule or very thin capsule, you want to force the body to improve the capsule formation. And this is really important for your malposition patients. You know, and examples would be massive weight loss patients. They often make terrible capsule. Women with heavy, heavy sun damage, prior smokers, people that just don't have good tissue and generally often don't make good capsules. It also seems to work very well in contracture patients, which is nice because, again, the dermal matrix is cost prohibitive, and many people, this is all paid out of pocket when they're managing contractures. So that's a majority of who I'm using it on these days.
And so you said you started off using more ADM earlier on in your mm-hmm. career, and you've kind of transitioned. What was the reasoning for wanting to use the current scaffold, the Galaflex mesh, as opposed to a cellular dermal matrix?
So, first of all, I think the cost ended up being the first driver, which is true of most things we do in surgery, is we start getting pushed into another area because something becomes too expensive to sustain. The other thing is that there was some things I was noticing with my dermal matrix patients that I was frustrated with. And one of the things I've battled for many years is that when the PDS dissolves, if the dermal matrix does not stay adherent to the chest wall where I sewed it down, my implant slips out of whatever I put it in. And this was true whether you completely wrap an implant or you just make a little sling underneath the muscle. So the mesh just does a nicer job Velcroing the implant where I put it, as opposed to being at the mercy of what the ADM stretch, capsule formation, and whatever happens when the PDS goes away. So I've just found it's a little more consistent with keeping an implant where I want it to stay.
A lot of the high volume ADM users talk about stretch. They talk mm-hmm. about implant flipping, the need for recurrent or revision surgeries to do capsularities. Are you seeing any of that in the Galaflex patients for the immediate direct implant reconstruction?
That's actually a fantastic question, because I just right now saw one of my dermal matrix patients with a flipped implant on Thursday of last week. I have not seen it, not one time, with my Galaflex patients. And I think part of the reason is it doesn't stretch. You're creating at least the method that I utilize, which is creating a precise pocket with both front wall and back wall coverage. I don't know how the implant could flip, honestly, because it's such a tight, precise pocket. Whereas with dermal matrix, even if everything is tight on the table, it's going to stretch. And it stretches enough that these higher profile implants are, it's a circus trying to keep them in certain patients in the right orientation.
And so, to your point, if you say that this Galaflex mesh in your hands is, you're not really seeing a lot of stretch, does that result in a certain consideration you have to have during your inset approach?
Yeah, I think whenever you're in setting, you're putting an implant in with mesh versus ADM, you just have to realize it is not forgiving and it's not going to settle. So, we always used to joke in the OR, you would do things and they wouldn't look quite perfect, be like, it'll settle. That is just not the case with Galaflex. It is not going to settle. So you have to lay that patient back down and fix it until it looks right on the table. And then for the most part, things stay where they are. The main downside I find with mesh is that you have kind of a perpetual implantee perky look, and you don't get some of the natural sag that many women want. So that needs to be discussed with patients when you're utilizing mesh versus ADM. I think they both have a place in breast surgery. It's just ADM is just becoming cost prohibitive in my practice, and it makes it very difficult to convince patients to sign on for that.
I have a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. Can I ask some questions? So in the, I'm old, so I trained in the subpectoral dual plane
yep.
breast reconstruction.
Me too.
right. I think we all are kind of cut from that same cloth. And then the big switch to pre-pec, I think that there's new challenges that are different than the challenges we saw when we did dual plane. And one of those challenges, I think, is some patients who don't make good capsules, less pocket control. And you can capsulography until your eyes bulge out of your head, but sometimes it just... And they look so great on the table. And they come back like a month later and it looks the same. And
you're boo.
So how do you, if you go to put Galaflex into, let's say, for example, into a pocket that's a prepectoral pocket where most of it's covered by ADM, mm-hmm. you just rough it up in there. And then how do you account for, let's say the pocket is now kind of overstretched.
Right.
And sometimes I will mastopexiate or tighten it or whatever, like if it's a nipple sparing. But sometimes there's just too much skin. How do you adjust for the difference in the skin envelope versus how big you want the implant to be and where you're going to, do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I've encountered this actually. So I find in patients where they're really bottomed out, like this isn't someone that I did 6 months ago and I'm fixing. This is someone who's been sitting like this in a prepectoral saggy breast for 6 years. that's someone that I got to take the ADM out and start from scratch. So I'll take the ADM out and I'll completely recreate my pocket with Galaflex. And then I find that when I do that, my soft tissue envelope will contract around the implant. If I don't take the capsule out or the ADM, it won't. And so then even if I have a beautiful, you know, Galaflex repair and the implant sits where it is, it's like the soft tissue always kind of hangs off of my implant in a weird way. So that one of the patients I showed today, I had done that. I took all of the ADM out. I fixed her muscle. She actually was subpectoral at one point, and I put her over the muscle, and everything looks great. But you know, in general, like I said, I was saying in the meeting, we just often don't talk about breast surgery with the respect it deserves. You know, people write papers for decades about all the layers of the nose and how this has to be right and that has to be right, but they don't do that for the breast. And the capsule, the soft tissue, the skin, everything has to be right. And so Galaflex is going to help you with the capsule, but if your skin and soft tissue is a wreck, that needs to be addressed. And you know, as you know, things will contract somewhat, but at a certain point you need to pexy them, you know, you need to do other things so that you have everything around the implant as it should be.
Follow-up question to that: when you do use Galaflex for your primary reconstruction for a mastectomy, are you seeing a difference in how long the drains are in versus,
you know,
using ADM?
It's funny because we talked about this when we were first starting, because the suspicion was, for whatever reason, is that Galaflex would be even more inflammatory. I have not found that. So my drains about 90% of the time come out at 7 days. So I put Provinavax on my patients.
Wow.
And they're putting out 20 or less by 7 days.
That's a big difference.
That's a big difference.
Most of us that are doing a lot of ADM,
and
minimum 14 days.
Right.
Minimum 14 days.
Yeah, so second drain.
I've been really.
I always put in a second drain because I don't trust anybody.
I've done one drain for years.
That second drain always lingers for that, like that.
Yeah, I mean,
visit.
I've actually stopped putting drains in for gal. Like whenever I do dermal matrix, I put a drain in because I just find they weep. And you know, when I do Capcons or anything, I put a drain in. I often don't need to for Galaflex. I've just stopped putting them in for a lot of my revisions, which is interesting because I know people were saying that they had, you know, anecdotally thought it made more fluid, but I have not encountered that at all.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think I can say, as someone with a moderate volume ADM practice, it's a totally different ball game.
Yeah
so that would be a big a very big and relevant thing, because we know Capcon is possible biofilm, and having a drain lingering for an extra 7 to 14 days,
it makes all of us nervous.
Helping.
Yeah.
It's painful for the patients. It's multiple post-op visits to have these drain sheets removed. So that really could be a game changer if people were able to produce the outcomes that you're producing in your hands. Another big question kind of in that line would be, what's the BMI of your patients? Because I know a lot of larger women, big pockets, bigger implants tend to produce fluid for longer and have
You know, it's variable. I think, you know, with my reconstruction practice, it's all over the place, which I think most of us, you guys, you might have a little bit bigger patients.
Yours is probably the biggest.
Mine are all over the place. You know, I think anytime you have a big pocket that needs to close down, the drain's always going to be in longer. So that's going to be like my 10% of patients where it stays in longer. You know, what we struggle with those, with our recon patients with larger BMIs, we don't have the implants that fit them. And we just don't have what we need to fill that space. And so I think having prolonged drains and dealing with this is going to be our burden to bear until we have better products for that patient population.
Yeah. So like the Galaflex that you're using, is it just a direct to implant cases? Mm-hmm. Do you ever use it with, like, let's say, like an expander or anything?
So I don't use tissue expanders in my practice. I have a kind of a unique practice where we have a breast center associated with us, and we have our own breast surgeons. So we do not deal with the chaos that you guys do at other places with, we don't really bad general surgeons, which unfortunately is the case in many places in the country. So the people that I know that love Galaflex and use it with expanders, they typically make a pocket with dermal matrix on the anterior surface and Galaflex on the back. I couldn't tell you, since I don't use it, whether their experience with implant position control is as good. My suspicion would be not as good, but I would
imagine. They don't have a choice because they're not going to be able to expand with a rigid.
You can't expand it.
Right.
Yeah, it won't work. So you have to do it that way.
So in the setting of the patient who is anticipated for radiation, mm-hmm. does your breast center feel comfortable radiating the implants?
Yeah, absolutely. We, you know, it's funny. It's very regional. I have a pretty big out of state.
It's
out
hard of no for us.
Yeah, it's you we do. Radiate them all the time, and we rarely have problems. I think most of us that use Galaflex and Dermal Matrix will tell you that Dermal Matrix wears better with radiation than Galaflex does. I have extremely competent people I work with locally in Los Angeles, and I feel I can use them interchangeably. When I have patients from out of state and I do not trust, they're going to end up like some of the photos you showed where there's yeah. you know holes in their skin and they're fried. I would probably do Dermal Matrix in those patients just as a precaution. But yeah, they're very comfortable. It is interesting though. Every once in a while, I'll have somebody that has a direct implant by me, goes back home to wherever they're from, and the radiation doctor will tell them it's, quote, impossible to radiate a patient with implants, and that's just not true, obviously.
That's yeah. the stance that my breast center take, and the kind of reasoning behind that is sometimes collateral injury to internal mammaries or into heart, lung, or just the logistics of that tangential beam if there's a highly projecting contralateral implant.
They all say that, but let me tell you, they've been doing it for decades now, and they're fine everywhere else in the United States. So they need to jump on board and allow women to have breasts and not force them into a tissue expander that they don't need. I find it so weird that they can't evolve. I mean, I was even at a plastics meeting last year, and one of the plastic surgeons was saying that, and I'm like, I'm sorry, it's just not the case. It's just not the case.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I trained at the University of Chicago, and we had a distinct split. At the academic center, they would not put an expander in even for radiation. At the University of Chicago, we made everybody flat.
Even when they
everybody
oh, really
so wow. no option for nipple sparing. And this was 7 or 8 years ago now. Wow. It may have changed, but
it was
everybody was radiated flat. Yeah, our private practice rotation, we go to 2 months of the year radiated implants. So in some instances, the lady could have a nipple sparing mastectomy, have a breast, have an implant that was radiated, and the way that they were radiating the patients, we just were not seeing the degree of Capcon that you see in some institutions. So I think protocol for radiation is really, really important, and that's where that you know multidisciplinary approach that you were talking about, Diana, is really, really important.
Well, and the patients that are being radiated properly are not dying of recurrences. That's the important thing to remember. It's just like these general surgeons that make these super thin flaps and kill skin 50% of the time. But yeah, I have a slideshow I show my patients getting radiation where I make them guess which side was radiated. You know, and most of my patients, you can't tell. And I think, but that's how it should be. I mean, patients should not be horribly maimed going through breast cancer treatment. It's just disgusting that these doctors won't get better.
I think you bring up such an important point because, you know, breast cancer is a systemic disease. So if the patient looks horrible, they're going to feel horrible, mm-hmm. you know, they don't sleep, their body can't recover. I find that sometimes like patients with like sort of lower status disease who have horrible outcomes actually get like recurrences of more horrible disease and don't progress. And that is something I do take into account. Like, you know, what kind of patient am I looking at? Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm going to do a complicated case, can they really go through the journey in their current, like, let's fight cancer stage? Mm-hmm. So I know in your practice, you do a lot of delayed cases, mm-hmm. but I do a lot more immediate cases. And that is something that I do look at, you know, if I look at somebody who, you know, may need radiation, and I'm usually fine with radiating because, you know, I've learned since my younger days to really, you know, use spy and make sure that there aren't any like, you know, unvascularized little corners or mm-hmm. something like that. But if you have a well vascularized flap and they do the proper dose appropriate radiation nicely, mm-hmm. Sometimes that side actually looks really great.
It looks like
they got like laser treatment cosmetically.
Yeah. Are you guys using Trentol in your implant patients that are being radiated? Is this popular where you are?
Mm-hmm.
So Trentol, you know, the medicine for claudication, mm-hmm. there's some evidence, it's mostly in the ENT literature, mm-hmm. from what I recall, that it minimizes radiation-induced fibrosis. And so I routinely give it to all of my implant patients being
Is
radiated.
Is that good for asthma?
No,
that's singular. I don't use that one. I know a lot of people do. Yeah, I just... think it works, honestly. But the Trintol, I think, does work. And there's, you know, there is some evidence in the ENT literature. So depending on who I work with locally, they'll either have the patients on it during radiation and then 6 months after, or just 6 months after, but also just a free radical scavenger on the skin. And they give them all, you know, vitamin E capsules, which don't work. Give them CE ferulic or some like real powerful free radical scavenger to protect the skin. And I think that's a decent idea too. I mean, there's things we can do. We can make this better.
They always put like some ointment that's like weird or like aloe. And and I just like put on Silvadine. I'm like,
right,
agreed.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Like your skin is peeling, you have a burn. Like here, like put this, you know. So sometimes there's ways to abate all those complications, and you know, it's okay.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point that you bring up, because, you know, in my practice, because the radiation is so heavy-handed at my breast center, if I know a patient is having a flap, I delay them all. I put a tissue expander in, even a nipple sparing, because if that margin is positive or that sentinel node flips from the frozen negative to now it's positive and they get recommended radiation, they will fry the flap. Yeah. And it's their way of helping the patient. Yeah. But unfortunately, cosmetically, it's really hard to recover and to put the patient through a major surgery. I just don't feel like I'm doing the best advocacy I could be for the patient. So unfortunately, because we're not working cohesively in that way, the patient's getting a whole extra operation, right? They wake up with a tissue expander, and 2 weeks later, when they get final path, they're going for a delayed D. But there's some pros and cons to that approach. But ultimately, I think in the patient that desires an immediate, you know, reconstruction, which Diana, you're doing a lot of that immediate autologous reconstruction, you have to be comfortable radiating your flap. So you have to be comfortable with who your radiation oncologists are and have predictable, consistent results.
And that's hard, because especially if you're going back 2 weeks later, it's nice that you have the OR availability to do your reconstruction, like if they're not going to get chemotherapy or radiation or whatever, and you can kind of jump to their deep flap, you know, once you have the final path back.
That's a lot of my patients usually aren't ready for that, so I can't even convince them 2 weeks later. You know, so that kind of doesn't happen. So I really do, we do have a multidisciplinary approach. We have like conferences on some of the more complicated cases, and like everybody chimes in. So, and it's been great, because sometimes I couldn't make it, but now it's on Zoom, you know, so even if I'm operating, like I'll like put an AirPod in, still be like talking. So that I can like really find out, and those are usually pretty helpful. Like sometimes, you know, I think I know stuff because, you know, I did a PhD in oncology, but I don't, you know, and there's all this new literature, and sometimes it, you know, it's surprising. So it's good to get that perspective. And so a lot of times they'll be like, oh yeah, like 80, you know, we kind of throw some statistics or whatever, you know, if it's like 20, then I'm like, let's go. You know, if it's like 80, she's going to get radiation, then I know.
Right.
And I too put a tissue expander, but then I'll just, you know, wait. And then I tell the patient, like, don't think you're going to finish your radiation and then we're going to have like this awesome surgery, because you're radiated like a nuclear bomb and nothing's going to heal. So they also have to be prepared that delayed is like really
How long do you wait?
So it depends. It depends on how much like skin damage and also the patient. The shortest I've ever waited, just because, you know, I'm old fashioned, 6 months. But routinely, if I think, you know, and sometimes the patient's not ready. You know, sometimes they need the time, or at least where I am, like the weather's nice or something. You know, people, and I do have a lot of teachers. So sometimes it's based on their availability and what they want. So that's why I do always, though, throw in tissue expander.
What's your wait time, like the interval post-radiation?
We tell them minimum 6 months. And depending on, believe it or not, my wait list for DEEP is a year. So
it's logistical.
Oh, because it's, so, because well, it's delayed? Should I like come over one day and we'll just like bang out a few?
It's just that we have such a high volume and a high need. There's five of us who do DEEPs in our practice. And
where are they come? Where are you?
We
like,
serve all of Kansas, a lot of Western Missouri, and some of Colorado. We're the only DEEP center between
like four states.
Between St. Louis and Denver, basically.
Yeah.
So we serve a lot, a huge area of people.
So are those patients like flying in the staying for like the week, or how is that managed?
Most of them are driving distance. Occasionally I'll have like a Western Kansas person that's 7 hours, and I try to get them to stay in town for like a week or two. Just, I'm more worried about them sitting in the car for 7 hours.
Right.
So like they get to day three, I'm not so nervous about what their flap is doing, but I'm more nervous about them having a PE.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah.
So it's great. So yes, minimum 6 months. It typically turns into longer just because our waiting list is unfortunately on the long side. But I have, so the case I showed at the end, that horrible radiation injury, that one I did at 3 months because she had an open wound and she was miserable and it was super painful for her. So that was a bear. It was the worst radiated chest we had ever encountered and dealt with. Fortunately, the microwall went fine. But
I find that sometimes when you have to go in early like that, it's just bloody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
it was.
Whereas like when you wait, like everything's dyed, you know.
So yeah,
it's just like white, you know.
Totally.
We dead. Actually don't we don't co-surge in our deeps. There are a lot of major centers that do co-surgeons, mm-hmm. because we have a fellow in residence and PAs and stuff. We don't do that. But I will say that. Just randomly, that particular case, mm-hmm. My partner Julie had like a random day. She wasn't doing anything. Was like, "Hey, do you want me to help out with your deep?" And this was early on when I first had started there. And I was like, "Sure, come on in. You know, more the merrier. So fun. It's so fun to be able to operate with your partners because we never get to do it." And I was so glad she was there because I typically do the belly and she was doing the chest. And that side of the chest, she said it was. And she's 10 or 12 years into practice. She's like, "This is the hardest chest I have ever seen done anything." So I'm
just making the like envelope and dissecting, or
no, getting getting the vessels out and getting that big radiated rind.
That's what I said. All your cases were these like left-sided radiated cases, mm-hmm. and I was like, "Wow, that must be like so hard because the vessel's always smaller."
Yeah, and so I know when she says it's hard, like I know it's hard. So I was really happy that I didn't have to take a resident through that.
Yeah,
like she could just handle it.
It's been our observation, just because of the logistics with COVID, we had some barriers with admitting patients to the ICU, so we could not do flaps for almost 12 months.
Oh, wow.
And so we had a big backlog, but what we did found is more time is helpful, especially in the severely radiated chest. The vessels are less fibrotic, less friable, and we were having an easier time in terms of dissecting the vessels out with a longer interval. So your wait list might not be a bad thing, especially in some of those heavily radiated patients that you presented.
Yeah, I never complain. I mean, I don't like that they have to wait so long.
It's like a transplant listing.
Right,
it is.
Trying to
get
organ faster.
Seriously, I know. It's heartbreaking to like tell a patient, like, especially we know they're going to need PMRT, and like, well, this is the operation that you really need, but you can't have it for a year. And most of them, as long as you set their expectations, I'm like, I'm going to put in a tissue expander. It's going to look great. Don't worry. Even once it gets radiated, it'll still fill your bra and it won't, you know, you won't be, and I give them the option to go flat if they want to, you know, you don't have to deal with a TE. Like I can still, like you saw some of my cases, they went from flat to flap and still had a beautiful result. And I just tell them like the TE is for you. It's for you to feel like you've got something in your bra. It's easier to wear clothes, etc. And some of the ones who live really far away are just kind of like, it's okay. Like, I don't want to deal with it. And that's okay. I think that that's a really important distinction to make to patients. Like, I'm not forcing you into this tissue expander, because there are certain expanders on the market that are really uncomfortable. I know you're so fortunate that you don't need to use them, but there are.
What are those? I've never heard of them.
Yeah, and you just want to save them the discomfort. So I've actually gone to using like the softest expanders I can find on the market, and
I use the smooth expanders.
I use smooth expanders. Yeah, I haven't, just like you, I haven't used a textured device in, I don't know,
a long time.
So Meredith, I know that, you know, one of your focuses on today's topic was really about raising the bar and really perceiving reconstruction as a cosmetic goal when we're reconstructing those women. And I particularly like some of your little tips and pearls relating to the abdominal donor site. So I wanted to ask, you know, both you and Diana, kind of any, you know, guidelines you can give to the listeners to see how they can improve the cosmesis of the donor site.
Sure. So we talked in the panel a little bit afterwards about you know, placating the abdomen. I think you can really turn it into a tummy tuck once the fascia is closed, plus or minus mesh. If you, you know, I think mesh increases the longevity of the flatness of your tummy tuck and prevents that sort of like lower pooching that can happen. Even if you preserve motor nerve, sometimes you still get some weakness of the abdominal wall, that lower part between the belly, you know, the umbo and the mons. I think that the way that the umbilicus looks is probably the most important.
Because I do mine the same way. I noticed your scar kind of curls in, so I do the same. I like, you know, by placing it so that it's deep, when you roll the outside,
yes,
in, it like really nicely tucks in.
Totally.
Yeah, and sometimes I like defat it a little bit on the really like kind of chunkier people, uh-huh, and then kind of defat it like a little bit around the area.
Yeah.
And that seems to kind of make it look nice too. Otherwise, it just looks like boosh ball, you know, like deep well. So.
Yeah, and it's the residents know and my fellows know, like that's one of the things I'm the most uptight about in that operation. So even when they're doing a lot of the, you know, they close the belly usually, I'm always watching the umbo to make sure that they do it the way that I want it and it turns out nice. And I think the other thing that's really important about the belly button is that you don't make it too small. Like you don't want it to be huge,
too
obviously.
Big,
it shouldn't be like a helipad or something, but you know, you don't want it to be so small that it looks sort of like stenosed, because mm-hmm, sometimes they can scar down. I showed one patient in the slide deck and I didn't point it out and I should have. This one where it just, it looked kind of unnaturally small. Mm-hmm. And I just look, it's not my favorite one. But I think the belly button is a big, important focal point. I think also excising generous dog ears when you lipo and go back for that second stage. And this is one thing that I said is, I tell everyone 100% chance you're going to get a revision. And so they know that they can expect that after they're deep. And I do my first revision minimum 3 months. And then if they, it's not common, I have to do a secondary one, but we talked about like fat grafting. And sometimes for the really skinnies or the ones where you're really transforming that breast, like that really difficult case, you just commit yourself to doing another, you know, more revisions. I'm trying to think other things in the belly.
Oh, the mons, and also
so
the position of where you're putting the drains and the drain sides, sizing them for the dog ears.
Yeah. I put the drains just lateral to. I used to bring them out the corner of the incision, and then I found that if you didn't suture it down tight enough around it, you get leaking, and then the drain would lose suction, and then you know, that's a disaster.
So exactly the same thing.
same for me as well.
I put it in exactly the same spot. Sometimes the only challenge is if you're already going around the world a little bit, I'll actually put it like underneath.
Just below.
Yes, just below.
Because
I know that's coming out later.
Totally.
No matter what. Yeah.
Totally.
But sometimes I just like can't get there.
Yes.
You know.
You know what I appreciated about both of your talks, and I think we don't talk enough about this in when we're discussing breast reconstruction, is that you guys, well, first of all, none of us at this table are going for symmetry in a bra. We're going for a beautiful breast on a woman without a bra. And I think the second thing is that I really like appreciated looking at your results because you were respectful of the woman's anatomy and breast shape. And I think we often in plastic surgery get fixated on ideal everything, and you'll see like flap talks and it's all the same patient. You know, they just choose the ones that are thin, that have a little bit of tummy extra, and they create this ideal non-totic breast that isn't the reality for most women. And I think breasts can be beautiful in all different shapes and sizes. And I think that's kind of a uniquely feminine perspective to aesthetic outcomes in plastic surgery. And I think that's one of the reasons why women are so important in this field, because we can take all different sorts of bodies and make them beautiful and whole. And I'm not trying to make you look like a girl with a BMI of 20 and a C-cup perky breast. I'm trying to make you feel like the woman that you were before breast cancer. And I really appreciated that about your guys' results, but also the fact that you go back and fix these things. Because I see patients all the time that are told, no, it's good enough. Says who, right?
Yeah.
Says
right.
Who? Good enough for who? That woman has those boobs for decades.
And you have to be able to admit that.
Right.
And say, like, you know, I still think we can make this better.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's hard to say. You know,
actually, for me, it's like actually really easy to say, because I think we're our worst critics sometimes.
Yeah.
But you're correct that sometimes it might not be the best to share with that patient if it's something, you know, so small and, you know, they might have other comorbidities that put them at risk. And as I saw with your talk, you offered it to a bunch of your patients. They were like, no, this is fantastic.
Yeah. Right. So. It's like, because we're the guide. And then you have that fork in the road, and I'm going to guide you, and you might decide not to go. And that's okay. But you should get that choice.
Particularly the patients who've gone through radiation have had problems. Sometimes just having a happy outcome, the first go.
Right.
They want good. They don't want, like...
You reset their surgery and medical karma, right? Yeah. I mean, you gave them something and they want to hold on to that, and maybe they don't want to risk it not being good the next time around. And that's okay. That's their journey in their life.
One thing we didn't talk about, I don't know if you... I'm sorry to interrupt you. But I'd be curious to hear, like, if you ever put implants behind deeps, because I have, and I don't like doing it. And one time the flap had some vascular problems.
So I've never done it immediate. I've had a handful of patients who wanted it afterwards, who didn't have the same sort of projection that they would get with just fat grafting. Mm-hmm. Every one of those I've regretted.
Yeah.
Is what I would say, because then they go through, like, my average age, as you saw, was 48. Then they go through, like, menopause, and, you know, their breasts get like side handles, and then they're like so unhappy because now there's an implant in there. And I've just regretted every single one.
It's just like a woman who gets an implant with a breast reduction, right? It doesn't make any sense to me to do that. That's another topic for another day. But I mean, you're having aging of two different types of things that age very differently. You know, if you put an implant in a small breast, they all kind of age together. But if you have big breast and an implant, which is kind of what you have with a flap, they're going to do different things. And I think you're going to be chasing your tail the rest of your life with that problem.
Have you done those? Or is this an admission?
No, I have done a few implants under deeps, and I'm like you. One lady did great, and she was happy with it. But
you had a problem with the pedicle?
I never saw the pedicle, but when I raised it, and it looked fine. Like, I put this little implant in, and I closed it. It was a very conservative implant. And then... she sent us a photo like 48 hours later, and it had this like ecchymotic, almost like
we all got goosebumps.
Not the whole flap. It was like this sort of like sunburst of, and I was like, oh my gosh.
So I think I know what that is, because I had that in a Lipsis Miss flap just like within the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're putting in something and you can expand it to whatever degree. And with the smooth expanders that I'm putting in, I don't want them to flip.
Right.
Even if I sew in the tabs and, you know, because they're going to be dissolvable. So I kind of like push it to its limit, but I have a brand new fat flap over there.
Right.
And I think sometimes it's the drainage, you know, and it's even almost worse on the pedicle flap because, you know, it's really learning. Sometimes with the deeps, they also, I find, at least on the smaller patient, so you probably had a skinny, small patient with a small vein maybe.
Yep.
And,
super,
you know,
small flap.
Yeah. So you're draining and that venous part needs to dilate a few days. So I really think it's like that added pressure on the tissue, like meaning it's not your pedicle. It's the ability for your like stuff to actually be able to let go. And in that circumstance, I mean, sometimes or early on, I put the bioptics on, the patient would stand up. And here they are, let's say they're really tottic, the envelope's like really big, and now the flap's like down here, and their drainage is up here, and the numbers always took a hit when they like stood up. And it makes sense because the veins have not like accommodated and dilated through the whole system. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a pressure issue, and it would go exactly in those little starburst yummy patterns.
That is so interesting because I did not, here it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like that modeled, because remember, the circulation is, here's your vein, you know, as if it was an occlusion. It has to go through, like, the whole system, like, through the meat, and then if in that matrix
where... It just was like this.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you can have like a tiny spaghetti strap, like almost nothing artery, but if it's open, it's going to shoot out so much blood into a system that can't handle the backflow.
Yeah.
So maybe with those, I would have probably hung her upside down and put like, you know what I mean? So that the pressure, because if she's sitting up, the anterior pressure of that implant is going to push on the flap. So I would have her like lay down and swing her upside down.
So I emergently explanted her like within in 2 hours. Like she called, I was in clinic and I was like,
come you here now.
Yes. I like ran out of clinic, took the implant out, and then she ended up with just a tiny little wound, but the whole flap survived.
Thank God.
So yeah. It was a win. It turned out fine, but not without a few gray hairs.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was the last time I did it, and I'll never do it. That was enough for me.
Well, because it's definitely a same situation. You've got that smaller patient. That's why I was guessing that, you know, it wasn't like 3 millimeter vein or something like that.
So some of the really tough ones are gals who have failed.
And was it only one side?
Yeah, so
the left side?
She had failed. Yes, it was left. She failed implant recon on the radiated side, and she had a healed implant. She was referred to me. Healed, very nice looking implant on the other side, which was kind of big. I mean, not big in general, but like big for her little BMI 23 frame.
Yeah.
And I was like, your belly is never going to match
that big implant.
This, right. So.
Did you downsize the other side then?
I think I did eventually.
Yeah,
I did. But I could. She didn't have enough belly for two deeps, right? So I only did the one side, and we've kind of always struggled to make them look the same because she has, you know, more projection, more ptosis. She has like no ptosis on her little flap, but she's happy and she feels a bra, and that's like all she really cares. I mean, you know, I know we say, and I. It's funny you mentioned that because my like speech that I give to all my breast cancer patients is, you know, this has been the traditional goal of breast reconstruction.
Yeah.
But my goal is for you to feel like
great.
You get out of the shower, and I want you to feel happy. Like, I don't want you to cry. I say it just that way.
I want you to look great naked.
Yeah. And I think
hot naked.
I think people all respond to that change different. You know, that's a whole other discussion. But she was just happy to have something because she had nothing, and she actually came to me with an open wound. So it was like better.
Yeah. And she had a different path.
So
I want to just pivot before we wrap up and ask you a couple of questions, Kelly, because I know that you have a lot of experience in revision reconstructions and secondary surgeries. And one of the bane of our lives, both as reconstructive and aesthetic surgeons, is capsular contraction.
Absolutely.
So talk to me about your approach. Talk to me about your non-surgical and surgicals and your tips and pearls, please.
So I know people love the vitamin E and the singular. We talked about it before. I just don't see that it works. And I'm going off of not only my experience, but I take care of a lot of contracture patients, and everybody tries this stuff, and I just don't find that it works. There's people in town that will do these ultrasound treatements. They do them right after surgery.
Ultrapsy-ish type of
that, exactly. And that's just nonsense. We all know that the firmest and weirdest time after any breast implant surgery is like 6 to 8 weeks, right? Before your initial healing starts or finishes, and then you go into remodeling. And so they just manipulate that fact by they start it at a month and then look, you're softer by 3 months. And it's like, well, of course you are. You would have been anyway. I think it's just a money grab, and I don't think it works. So I don't do any non-operative stuff. I mean, in my mind, if you have a contracture, you have a contracture, and there's usually a reason. You've got a ruptured silicone implant, or you have
a nidus.
You have some biofilm nidus of some sort, your implant or I hate ethabons. We were talking about in the thing. I hate ethabons in the breast. Please don't do it.
What about black silk?
I hate black silk. I mean, I hate anything that's braided in particular that doesn't really go away. And I know silk technically is not a permanent suture, but it's there 20 years later. So I don't know when it goes away. But
yeah, I was watching you pick out your little ethabons, and I was thinking, me and my little black silks.
Oh, they drive me. I have a little pile of them sometimes. But, you know, so in my mind, you have to always solve the problem that's leading to the contracture. And those are the typical problems. Every once in a while, I'll have someone that has a history of like a gnarly hematoma that the surgeon didn't train.
Right.
And sometimes those can relate and have a contracture later too. So I just treat every contracture patient as though they have all of those things. So when I go in, I always do microgen. We talked a little bit about that. I do think that managing biofilms is really important. Mm-hmm. It's not an expensive test to send. And I think what I tell patients, you know, they're often financially and emotionally exhausted when they come to me. And I'm like, how exhausted and financially are you going to be if we do three more surgeries on you? Let's get it right this one. So I will send a microgen. I always do a complete capsulectomy. I just don't think you can leave any of it behind. I think it seeds the next capsule, and you just got to get it out, as annoying as it is. And these can be really challenging surgeries because they're often, especially the long-term ones, are very, very high up in the axilla, and you need to get out your long instruments, and you know, you're cursing everyone. Your assistant wants to fire you, and you know, they're terrible cases, but you just have to do it. You have to get all of that out. And I've really I used to try to convert everyone to under the muscle, because we know that typically you have lower contracture rates. And, you know, for those of us that go back, the capsule is always thinner under the muscle than everywhere else. That being said, I have a really big problem with fibrotic retracted muscles in these recurrent and long-term contracture patients. And so I have gone more to over the muscle reconstructions of these guys. I find that my results are the same with dermal matrix or mesh. And so I've started using both. I know there's a couple people that are going to publish data hopefully this next year on their experience with Galliflex in particular with contractures. But I just think, you know, I rarely have recurrences, knock on wood. And I think that it's because I just do all of the things. And patients often don't want to pay for things. You know, they try to nickel and dime themselves out of everything, and I won't do it. You know, my goal is to solve this problem, and this is the way that I think is the best to solve it. And there you go. The other thing that I think, the things that I think have been really helpful with my CapCon patients are phase one. I use phase one extensively around implants. I will shoot 20-30 cc's of it up the drain at the end of my case and leave it there for, you know, 10-15 minutes and let it drain out. And in the operating room. And I think that that is a game changer. I mean, I think that's a really effective manager of biofilms and all of the bugs. So I think, I don't know, I've converted to phase one. And then, you know, the other thing too is that I've been very aggressive with patients with all of their healing afterwards. I think that, you know, I use Provinavax a lot on people. I make sure that they are taking care of their bodies and they're not doing too much. And, you know, this area has misbehaved so extensively. We are not going to let it do it again. You're going to do everything right or I won't be your surgeon. And I've had really good results.
I do the same thing. Okay, so you can like go out to dinner, but then you have to lay down for me.
Right.
And it's sort of like an ongoing negotiation, yes. But I do the same thing. I'm like, if you want to have a complication, this is, you know, what it is.
Well, it's the bucket of energy philosophy, right? Like we all have a bucket of energy every day. And so when you've had surgery, a big chunk of your bucket of energy is going towards healing that area. Mm-hmm. And so if you are using too much energy, you may not heal as well. And I think that's like a really simple way for patients to kind of understand the metabolic stress of healing a big area. And even though the incision's small, we did lots of stuff inside. I mean, right. That's a lot of surgery, these CapCon surgeries.
Yeah, I even put them on a gram per, milligram per kilogram of your body weight protein. Mm-hmm. Is like a requirement.
So definitely
if you
not
weigh
wrong.
Like 60 or 80.
I utilize Juven.
Yeah,
it's a wound healing supplement, which has really good nutritional value in the yeah. acute.
That
healing
I think
patient.
Makes a really big difference, not just in healing but also infection and recovery. So
absolutely.
I definitely do that.
So question for a primary presentation, so a first-time presentation of capsular contraction, are you going to mesh, like an interpositional mesh or a full wrap mesh
always.
As a first
yeah.
approach?
Mm-hmm. Always. Okay. Yeah, I'm not messing around. You know, I mean, the reality is that some people can be cleared with just a capsulectomy. But, you know, especially if they're under the muscle's often bizarre after the capsulectomy. It's not sitting where it should be. Your breast it's just so much easier for me to get you looking the way you should look if you let me use ADM or some kind of mesh.
What I really like about that approach is I think for some patients with a paucity of tissue or
right.
a thin skin envelope, when you do a total capsulectomy, you destabilize the breast. And
absolutely.
They're really prone to ptosis on the capsulectomy side. Mm-hmm. So by using a rigid mesh, essentially you're taking the tension off the breast parenchyma, off the breast skin envelope, and probably reducing the risk of going having to go back to do mastopexy on that patient.
Yeah, no, I agree. I totally agree. And I, you know, when I first was out after fellowship, I did a bunch of capsulectomies on patients with Capcons, and I cleared their Capcons, but they looked weird. They just didn't look normal on that side. And I do think that there's a very important place for either mesh or ADM when you're doing a contracture patient.
Okay. Well, ladies, thank you very much. Was there any other pointers that you wanted to discuss about your respective topics?
No, I want to say I just really enjoyed the panel. I thought everybody was just very honest. And I think I'm just very grateful to be part of it.
Thank you for listening to the WPS Remix Edition of the Plastic Surgery Hot Seat Podcast, brought to you by the ASPS Women Plastic Surgeons Forum. We hope you found our coverage of the WPS Symposium informative and engaging. Remember to subscribe to our podcast, check out our other episodes on your preferred platform, or download them directly from ASPS EdNet. Stay tuned for more insightful conversations and expert advice to help you navigate the latest trends and challenges in plastic surgery.